Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Let's Talk podcast. I'm your host, Reese Wright. The goal of this podcast is to connect with real people and share real stories about the ups and downs of a creative life. I'm so glad you're here, so please grab a chair, pour yourself a drink, and let's just talk together.
Start here with my journey. How to be successful without ever being cool. I feel like I feel very qualified. Never been cool, not one second. But but I figured out how to get invited to things anyway.
Yeah, weren't you like at the Emmys? Like
yeah, because my friends are cool and they brought me along.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was Austin Butler there?
I don't know, but I will tell you that I stood alongside him through the step and repeat press line when I was at the Oscars for my own work. Yeah, because that was the year of Elvis. So he was just next to me in a lot of things. We never spoke, but he sure did look like Elvis. Okay. So I moved around a lot. I went to 13 schools. My parents were in hotel management. So like Ramadas and Sheratons and stuff. So my dad would fix up a property and then get transferred or fired or whatever, and we'd go somewhere else. So I'd usually start at one elementary school and then during Christmas break move to a different one all around the U.S. Dang, that's right. And so usually teachers were trying to figure out what to do with me because I also started reading at an early age, and so teachers became like my friends because they were always trying to figure out how to challenge me. I was a bit of a curiosity. I wasn't going to stick around for long, probably. So because I was lonely, I wrote a lot of stories. And my dad was kind of an aspiring writer. My mom was an excellent audience. So between the two of these people, I just started writing stories. And, you know, I was the kid that at the slumber party would make up the story while we were all going to sleep about being trapped in the school with all the boys we liked. Like, this was who I was pretty early on. Yeah. In high school, I wrote in a notebook, like a chapter of a story every day, and it would get passed around and then brought back to me at the end of the day or the next day. I low-key invented blogging, I think is what that means. Then I found theater in high school and I went to UT for drama. But I also was always kind of writing, and I had teachers tell me that my writing was strong. I went into a playwriting class while doing local. I did a local theater festival contest called Frontera Fest that still runs at the Hyde Park Theater in Austin. And that was the first time I had like not just performed and heard an audience, but I heard them list like I was in the audience while a play that I wrote was happening. And that feeling of an audience like reacting around me and about the things I was thinking about, it was such a instant like, oh, I want to do this. And then I was also like at the very, very early of the internet. So I did have a website before there were blogs. That was, you know, what blogging became. And I wrote for an early website called Television Without Pity. So that was like the creation of recapping for television. And I wrote for the local paper, I had like a comedy thing. So basically I was just anywhere I could try to freelance and figure out how to freelance, I was doing. I was just constantly making, creating, or performing while having, once I graduated and even during school, a job at IBM. I just didn't want to wait tables or work in a service industry because I grew up in it and saw my parents just never really had a day off, never really had a night off. They were always having to be on call. And, you know, so early in the internet that they were just like, they'd hand you a piece of paper, like, could you put this on the internet? And you could be like, yeah, I can do that. Even though I look younger than you can imagine, I'm going to go do that for you. So I basically saved up money through that, was performing through that, and got to where I was getting told, hey, if you're ever in LA or New York, if you move, give us a call and we can keep working, you know, figure out some way to work together. And I was just sort of, you can stay in Austin and have a wonderful life with all of your friends and feel fulfilled as an artist and a performer and a family person. And, you know, like you could live in Austin. It's great. I had aspirations that I could not do in Austin anymore. Like I had reached the edges of what I could do. So I was really one of the last of my friends to move out to LA 25 years ago and some change, and came out here with nothing but some internet jobs that all went away on 9/11, and had to just sort of start over again. But during that time, I had taken my website and turned it into like the concept of a book. This was also before this was a thing where a popular website would then become a bunch of essays that become a book. So I had created a novel, because people were like, you talk to people on the internet and people write to you and send you presents. Like, nobody understood any of that. But that became a book. So my first published book was called Why Girls Are Weird. That ended up becoming my first screenplay sale. My second book, Why Moms Are Weird, which is about hoarding, really, and your mom dating, which was also before the show Hoarders. I'm not going to say that if my whole life was maybe like 1 month later, I'd be sitting here in my pool talking to you about my legacy and my conglomerate. But So that was my first TV sale. And then those shows didn't get made, but I did get to write a couple pilots and really broke into the industry that way. My third book, hang on, Roller Derby, came out after Whip It, but it was not like whatever. And then, anyway, by the, I was doing comic books at this point, and I really jumped a whole bunch of things, because by the time the fifth book came out, I'd been working in TV at this point and had a spec script that got attention at Pixar and Disney, which led to some meetings, which led to me getting a job that was eventually called Moana. And so that was my first TV Disney animation job. And that led to some other animated films and a good number of years working in as a writer in animation. And then in the middle of that, we published a memoir, which was about all the notes that I wrote to boys. We circled back from my imaginary boyfriends that were celebrities to my imaginary boyfriends who were real boys. I wrote a lot of notes to boys. I kept all the first drafts because I'm regular and normal. And I kept them and moved them many, 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 many times and started putting them on my website. This whole time I was still writing PayMe.com. And it got such a nice reaction. And by that I mean it mortified people. So I also was reading them at a book reading. And my publicist, who had a small publishing house, said, I think maybe little Pam should get her own book. So that memoir got the attention at FX, and they said, maybe you could do some short form independent animation with this and play around with the form and not in this giant, you know, CGI 3D, like giant Disney pipeline that you've been in that takes 5 years to make a movie. At the same time, I started working on, was I finishing Ralph Breaks the Internet? I can't remember, because time is weird, because then we had a pandemic and everything went away. And so I had a lot of time. I was working on Nimona, which got shut down while we were working on it. And then I had a lot of time to work on this tiny little animated thing about my high school love letters. And that became, that was my year of dicks. So when we came out of the pandemic, I had dicks that I went with for a year. We ended up going to the Oscars. That's its own long story. And then Nimona got made, and that came out the year after. So that is a long version of my journey. That is mostly about like places I sat or things that I can tell you were moments that I felt like, oh, this was a big thing that happened. But I just described like 25 years and millions of words at this point, I guess. But nobody's journey is the same. And I don't think you really even know you're on the journey until you say a sentence like that to someone or a paragraph where you're looking back and going, oh, that was when all the little stops on the drive. But I also feel like I'm still just getting started and trying to figure out what I'm going to do next. And I'm working on things that I've never done before. And that Reese is involved with. And so for me, I feel like I follow where I'm curious. I follow what looks fun. And whenever I'm working somewhere, I try to think, how can I make this better for whoever comes in after me? And what can I take from this for my next one, you know, for whatever happens next? And I think that has helped. I really always want to feel like these jobs are so long that you gotta think about the stamina of a Thanksgiving weekend. You know, like mm-hmm. you have the meal right at the beginning, and then you just have all these days, right? So you have to figure out how to not just endure, but like get out of it what you wanted. You know, also remember to nap.
Napping is very important as a college student.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important.
I mean, college is that time. College, I think the way that you do college will help you know how you like to do your 20s. Because if I have a regret about college, I was constantly doing something. I had, you know, I had a job when I, for like half of it, because my parents couldn't help with school anymore. And I was also writing and performing, and I started as a double major that the deans basically said, you can't possibly balance this, you have to choose. And I think if I have a regret, I didn't get to take advantage of the city of Austin, because I was so focused on the world of my campus that I missed out on a lot of Austin 90s culture, theater, comedy, music in particular, because I was such a, I got to get my homework done, I got to get this turned in, I'm going to do the things I need to do. And I probably was so hard on myself. But whatever, perhaps that's why I have a good work ethic and I can, yeah, still working now. Like, I understand that it's really shiny and pretty out there, but I have to stay home and work. But I think I probably could have eased up on myself a little bit. But ever, like, from when I was little, I was always like driven to get to a place that made me happier. And I felt like college was that shot that I had to like get myself to a place where I'd be happier. Not that I wasn't happy in college. It felt like, oh, now I'm in my own world where I get to make my own decisions and still have the guardrails of school.
I love it. What do you think? What's your take on like people that are like, if you're a film major, or if you're a this, you like shouldn't go to school for it. Mm. You should just YouTube and stuff.
Well, I never went to film school, but I work in film. So there's a version of that answer that I understand. But I did go to school for theater, and I did a lot of stuff locally. I was filming me and my friends from high school on, like, that stuff I filmed is in my Year of Dicks. So, you know, you never know. But you go for the community. There's one reason. You go for reassurance. I got into a lab out here and for Film Independent, and I ran into a friend of mine that day. She's a producer, F.E.T. Brown, and we were on an elevator, and she said, I saw that you got into that lab. She said, I really look forward to you finding out that you already knew everything you needed to learn. And it's really set in me, like, when she said it, I was like, I hope she's right. Like, I really hope that the lab helps me get the confidence to trust my gut. And I think when you're first starting out, in particular, nobody knows your voice yet. So you're figuring it out, but you're also figuring out how to talk about your voice, how to talk about your point of view so that people can see what you're saying or make the things that prove out what you want to do. And eventually people start to understand, usually through some version of success where they're like, oh, that worked. Now I like you. You know, it's not always the most fair, but it is a way to start to have a community, do work, be seen, get a group of people together, get people that get you, and get curious and excited and interested about things. That can you do all of that while you have a degree that's really hard and time consuming, that has its own path to success that you might end up on? I don't know. Because a path that's working, you will probably follow. And a path to an industry job is often one that's not working at all. Like, even when it's working, it's not working. And then maybe it's working, but you're not working. You know, it's like.
Okay, wait, there's... like playing into that though, like after you go to, like, say you have, you know, like you do Moana, mm-hmm. like what comes after that? Like, do you instantly have another job after that? Or is it like.
Well, like when I was off of Moana, that movie not only hadn't come out yet, I don't think it was announced. And you aren't allowed to talk about it, you know, because these are big top secret jobs. So I just suddenly didn't have a job one day. And two things happened. One was that internally, another director was interested in me for a film that he had coming up. That was Ralph Breaks the Internet. And another studio had met with me because of I went to the Austin Film Festival and met some people, and word got around that, oh, you should meet this writer, she's funny. And so I had met over there just like a general hi. And then they wanted me for Smurfs the Lost Village. So I was fortunate enough to have the time to be able to go over there and do their movie. But also this director for Ralph was like, but please don't go too far or for too long, because I'd like you to come on this one. But he wasn't going to be ready for a year. He wasn't going to be ready for a year. Oh. And I couldn't just be like, well, I'll sit here for a year and wait. Maybe it was 9 months, but it was a long time. It was a long time before I actually went on to that other job. And it was while I was working on Ralph that Moana came out, I think. Yeah. Well, it was when, yes. So I had just gotten into a very small world. Animation is a very small world. And a studio that was considered, you know, if you're working there, you're one of like, there are only like 10, 12 of us working at any point in the major animated studio films. I mean, maybe it's more now, but at the time, it was not. I mean, there are fewer animation studios now. I don't know. You can count on them. You could build a football team. That's about it. Gosh. With feature animation writers. And they were like, the interest came from being an independent screenwriter, because they're looking for people who can, they don't need you to make up a lot of the world. They're in charge of the world. So they're looking for writers who write with a lot of heart, who know how to be funny and make characters that are memorable and have interesting dynamics. So I didn't write like an animation script or a family friendly script at all that got me all the, it was actually my very first screenplay on top of that. That often was the calling card for the first 15 years of my career. When I hadn't even read a book on how to write a play or a screenplay. I had written some plays and I'd read a lot of books and I'd read a couple of screenplays. And then I just wrote with my heart. I wrote the first one in 4 days. That's how much you can just like get something done when you haven't given yourself a lot of rules. And that's not to say it hasn't gone through so many rewrites, but at the time I definitely felt how to write that story because it was personal and I knew the ending, which is very important. And then learned a lot from having finished it. You know, often when people are like, I think I want to be a writer, like you have to by yourself write a few things. I'm pretty sure I've told you this too. Like you have to get to the end of something, more than one thing, to see if you like this, because the job, like writing is not just starting and not just writing. Writing is finishing and then going back and writing it again and again and again. And if that process is horrible to you, and it is horrible, nobody's like, I love it. Nobody, I don't think anybody loves the act of birthing that first draft. And so because it's the hardest, you really have to see, do you have the stamina, the curiosity, and the work ethic to do that horribly hard part over and over again? And then the other half of balancing this career is, do you have the ability to talk about yourself, put yourself out there, meet people, think on the fly, how good are your improv skills? And this isn't to say figure out how to be someone else. It's figure out how to be yourself the most, how to really represent yourself, your internal world and your external world, so that you seem like someone who would be fun to work with, who is going to turn things in on time and wants to be someone who is going to be part of something bigger than just them.
What do you think is the hardest part of the writing process? Like the actual act of writing, or then the rewrites, or showing it to someone, etc.?
For me personally, writing that first draft is so hard. It is really hard because I guess because I'm I do allow an element of exploration and need it while I'm writing. I can't just like this. These are the pages and I'm going to write them. Feels like it takes a little bit of the joy out of it, but it takes that curiosity out of it for me. But that causes a problem because I get curious and I'm writing, and then all of a sudden, you know, what I thought I was going to write maybe isn't it, and I don't know where I'm going with this anymore. And then you're trying to put together like what you used to think was going to work, and now it won't because you've done all this other stuff. And then you feel like, I will never ever 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 get to the end of this. I will work for 4 or 5 hours, and at the end of the day, that script will be 2 pages shorter. That happens all the time. And you feel like you're unwriting. But
unwriting. I think we should. That's a word, right? Yeah, unwriting.
It is now. That's the name of this episode. Unwriting. Unwriting. With Pamela Riven.
What's that one song? Unwritten. That's what I'm thinking of. Feel the. Never mind. I'm getting
that is a word. That is a word.
I'm just full of side tangents, I think. That's
fine. I don't think having someone read it is the scary part, except the part that happens inevitably is they need time to read it, and telling yourself during that time that it isn't quiet because nobody knows how to tell you you're terrible at this. You have to keep reminding yourself they just haven't read it yet. It isn't that they're dreading it. It isn't that they don't know how to tell you that they no longer think you're a good human being. It isn't that they are like all in a room talking about you. Like none of that is happening. None of that is happening. That's your storyteller brain trying to give sense of the silence. And the silence has one explanation. They haven't read it yet. Or they're waiting on the meeting to talk to each other about having read it and someone hasn't read it yet. Or they're all at Sundance. Like that's it. Three reasons. But you will play with your brain all the time because we need to. So I just make sure that as soon as something is turned in, I clean, I shift my desk, like I shift where everything is so I have a different view so that my brain can go, okay, you put away that time. I think about how that script will only be that script this one time and that's it. Like it's going to change from here on out. So good job. You did that draft and you found things in it probably that you like, and there's things in it that you know aren't working and that you hate. But I don't consider that time. I find that time to be mine. It's like the only time that gets to be mine because it's the only time the script is not on my plate. So it's okay. Take your time.
When I sent you the screenplay that I wrote for my friend, I think that was like the scariest. That was the scariest thing I did in 2025.
Send me a script?
Yes.
That's crazy.
That was terrifying. And I felt awful about it. I don't know why. I was like, this is like the first real like thing that I've written. And it's like, ew. I don't know.
Did you like it before you sent it to me?
I thought it was okay.
Uh-huh.
You know.
And then how did you feel after? Not before you heard from me again, but when you hit send, is that when you decided I've made a terrible mistake?
That was when I was like, I should have a panic attack right now. I should, you know, when you, okay, this is really specific. You know, when you're at a sleepover with your friends and they're like, oh my gosh, just send that like risky text. And then you send it and like throw your phone and like go panic around the room. Mm-hmm. It was mm-hmm. that for sure. Mm-hmm.
What were you risking sending it to me?
You could be like, this is the worst thing I've ever read in my entire life. You're mm-hmm. horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't that.
No. Did that seem likely on a, like in the, I would say a one out of 999,000 chance? Easily. So I don't know that I've ever said that to anyone because it's not a good note. It's not helpful. I mean, I guess I would say it to someone who was trying to break up with me with a script, then I would be like, this is the worst thing I've ever read, ever in the history of reading. But even then, it probably had its points. It was probably formatted well. But it was just a nice page count. I could read it. But I feel like this stuff is where we get in our own way. The stuff where we get in our own way is particularly hard, I think. Well, I was going to say it's harder when you're younger. I don't know that that's true, because what I'm about to say happens in both directions, which is you get used to telling yourself no first. And you listen to yourself, because we tell you to listen to yourself and listen to your gut. But your gut and your brain don't necessarily say the same thing for a long time, or maybe often. So that unique moment when your gut and your brain are saying the same thing is such a big yes. And it takes some training for your brain to listen to your gut, because your brain's done a lot of good for a long time now, particularly in school, when your gut is like, I think we should skip class today. Your brain is like, no, we cannot do that. We cannot do that. But in terms of like artistic stuff in particular, and these kinds of leap of faith stuff, that is all out of your head. You can make controlled risks. You can make reasoned risks, but the risk part will always be a little like, this is crazy, right? There's always an element of that. And yeah, the more you are successful with your calculated risks, the bigger the jump you'll start to make. But I mean, it is a huge jump to pick a college. It is a huge jump to move towns. It is a huge job. It's a huge jump to say, I'm going to finish the script and I'm going to send it to someone. So all of those then need the hindsight that we were saying, where you can look back and be like, that was a good idea. And when you have enough of those, that was a good idea, you stop hopefully getting in your own way. Because so many people are going to say no to you on this journey. There's so many people who say no. It's just the thing I say that, like, so many people say no. So many people will say no to this career, your chances, your stakes, your tries at bat. So you don't need to be the first one. You get to be the last one who says, okay, that's enough here. I'm going to go try something else. I'm going to start a different script. I'm going to change jobs. I'm going to pivot. I'm going to try television. You know, any of these choices are yours to make. Some of the decisions, unfortunately, aren't yours to make. Do you get the job? Do they hand that script to the person you want? Does this person ever read it when they say they will? You can't control that stuff.
What's like the riskiest jump that you think you've made?
Well, I guess you need to define risk.
Oh.
Because there's small risks. There's personal risks, right? Like, they're all different.
What about personal risk? Just like stepping out of your comfort zone somehow, I guess.
Well, I would say moving to LA was one. You know, I'd moved around a lot enough to know that, like, I could go back, but I did not want to. I left thinking I'm not coming back here. And so to stick through it, I've been through more than one strike, you know, the pandemic, the fallout of 9/11 and all of that stuff. And many, the industry's broken. There will never be a job. We're currently in one, and it's really, really hard. So it is risky to keep staying. It is risky to then bet on yourself more than try and get in on someone else's job, right? So most of the jobs I have now are through my, like, ideas or pitches. Even the ones that I have that are for a studio and some other IP, it was like my take that got me the job, right? So that's different than working on someone's show. That's risky, because these things could go in any time, but they could go in any time on someone else's show. And then, you know, making the documentary that I'm making right now, that's a huge risk because we don't have, you know, a distributor or full financing. Like, we're in the middle of this thing and I have to figure out how to help us land this thing, like end it with money. So, you know, trying to make a documentary when like all of the grants got canceled like 2 weeks after we started is scary. This feels like the biggest risk I'm taking, and I think it's because I'm in it and I cannot tell you how it works out, if it does or not, and or how it does. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. So it feels like the scariest thing that's going on.
Are you excited about it?
Yes, I'm excited about it. I'm also in that place where I don't know. I'm just past the initial excitement of we're putting this thing together, the excitement of we filmed all that stuff, and now I'm in the, are we going to pull this off? And it's, it is exciting. It is rewarding. Having met all of you and getting to spend, you know, 6 months plus, I mean, it's been a year now. It's been more than a year since we met, in your worlds, to remember what it felt like, but also to feel like we're still not all that removed from each other, and how it feels to dream and want and try, you know, to be around a world that is exciting and joyous at a time when I would say those are two words we don't use for the world at large, or even our cities at small. Like, it felt really, it was rewarding, but it also felt necessary. So then it doesn't feel like as much of a risk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the first time like we met, I was terrified of you. I think I already told you that, but like, yeah.
We were dressed alike. And you were introduced to me as someone incredible. So I was not terrified to meet you. I was excited to meet you.
I was terrified.
Again, what was I going? What Matilda world are you imagining where I would have just been like, not her, though?
It was just so like random. They were like, yeah, like the whole crew is here. And like I walked into the room and I remember I walked over in like a little corner with some students, and they were like, they were just like whispering. They're like, that's her. And then you like walked up to me and you were like, hi, are you Reese? And I was like, yeah. And you asked me about like my struggles of like being a filmmaker, but like a student filmmaker. And I told you, and you were like, yeah, like I totally feel that. When I was writing Moana, and I was like, cut the cameras, guys, cut the cameras. Don't even start rolling. Just cut the cameras right now. I was like, cause I had like done research on you before we met, but I was like, who just casually drops, yeah, when I was writing Moana, like I felt the exact same way. Mm-hmm. But then like we got to meet you and, you know, talk to you for, like you said, like 6+ months. And it was like, oh, like, yeah, you're just like,
I became a person, like a regular person.
Yeah, like, I don't know. Like, it was just like, you were like a little member of our family. Like, it wasn't like scary. Like, we would go to, you know, other competitions, but like mm-hmm. other places. Mm-hmm. And
it's not a secret. I feel like, are we supposed to not talk about this? We can totally talk about this.
Okay. I didn't know, like, if. Okay,
please send your money. If this sounds interesting to you and you have $5. we need to finish our documentary about the one-act play. But yeah.
But when we were like going to like different competitions, we would like, you know, be like, yeah, we're working with this like documentary crew. And like, we would call you guys like, you know, the Netflix people or whatever.
Yes, and yes. Then...
Well, you saw the footage, so like, you know, but like.
I do.
Yeah. But like, whenever we would tell like people that were not a part of the project, like, yeah, the woman that, you know, is directing it, she's like pretty, you know, she's pretty important. And we'd like tell them like, oh, these are some of her projects. They would like freak out. But like, we'd be like, no, it's just Pam. You know, she's amazing. And like, yeah, she's really cool. And yeah, she listens to our jokes. And yeah, like, it's just like, yeah, she puts up with our Austin Butler talk and our Pedro Pascal. That's an Izzy Cruz reference, by the way.
Yes,
for the people that don't know.
Yes, the text thread of everyone's desired boyfriends. I stopped using imaginary because it's real if you believe it.
But I feel like that's the stuff that, like, I guess for me really pushes me to want to be in film is like the connections that you make.
Yeah.
I feel like that's really, really special. So I feel like you connected with all of us and we love you. So
oh, great. This feeling is mutual. It's yeah, I miss it. Feels strange that everybody's like rehearsing their one acts right now and not calling to tell me how it's going. I'm not getting new footage. And so I live in this world of last year and I'm watching it all the time and having to check back in with how I feel. And what's interesting is as a writer, as soon as the season ended and competition was over, as a writer, you're like, now I can start the script because I know how it ended. But I don't, because the story isn't really over. And also I wasn't in control of the story. I was only an observer. So now in edit, it's now you're kind of making the script. When do we meet people? And when do we want, are we caring enough about them? Did we see this person long enough? How is it going to end? Where should we start so that it feels good at the end? What journey am I taking the audience on? And there's new people that come in to do that. So, you know, you're onboarding new people and you're learning how they're seeing this and what their expectations are. You know, I think a lot of people here, this is a documentary about a one-act play contest in Texas, and they think, oh, this is going to be a movie about theater kids being extra, you know, and it just isn't. You're gonna be like, first of all, you're gonna wish you did this competition. And then secondly, you're gonna be like, those people were amazing. Every single one of them was so good, such a good person trying so hard. And it, like, that goes back to, like, I really enjoy watching people attempt their dreams, you know, and I love little undiscovered worlds that you get to be just like immersed in. And you don't have to suddenly know everything about Scrabble to be at a Scrabble competition, right? In this case, you don't have to memorize a bunch of Lorca or Brecht. You can just sit with these high schoolers who did it for you. So it is fun. It is fun. But yes, it's a daunting task where we're at right now, because it is hundreds of hours of footage.
That's fine. You can say that we were your favorite school. It's okay. You don't have
to. I'll say it to you, and I'll probably say it to anyone from any school who asks, because everybody had a very different personality.
How many schools did you guys have to, like, go to?
I can't remember how many I reached out to at the beginning, because it's, I don't know, 20, 25 probably. And in the end, 7 or 8-ish. We started with 10. And then the reality of reaching schools or how much footage they could do on their own or you know, in one case, I think a school's administration said, actually, no. But like a good 7, 8, 8. We have 8 for sure. Y'all, you know,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Y'all were getting footage from 8 schools.
Well, you don't know how far anybody's going to go. So you had to kind of, you know, from zone to state, that's 6 contests, you know, district, by district, area, region, state, 6 contests. And not everybody does zone. So, you know, when you get into the weeds of it all, and also I wanted to show that there's so many different kinds of Texases in Texas, from 1A to 6A, but then also from Dallas to, you know, the Valley. Those are very different Texans.
A lot of people think Arlington, Texas is like a little small town. It's not.
It's not, and it's, but it is very suburban.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that is, I don't think that when you talk about Dallas, you are also talking about Arlington. You know,
like I always tell people, like, DFW, but like in college, people have gotten really, really smart about that. Like, I told someone, and I was like, yeah, I'm from Dallas. And they were like, but are you actually? Whoa. Chill. Whoa. If you look at DFW, I'm like, probably right outside the FW. Like, chill. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. You could just say, I'm where the Six Flags is. That's what I would say.
That's really good. Like, I'm not by the eighth, I'm not by like the Cowboys Stadium. Go the opposite.
Yeah. Because when people are like, you're from LA, you know, if you lived near Disneyland, you don't really live in LA, but like, you live in LA. It's fine. You live in Anaheim, but it's fine. You're going to say.
Wait, do you guys have, what is the weather like there right now?
It's 71 degrees outside right now. It was chilly. It was chilly this morning. It was in the low 50s, I think, but it's 71 now. It's going to be cold next week, I saw.
I live in Texas, so my cold is a little bit, you know, yeah. Yeah. But what was it like, going back to the whole documentary thing.
Sure.
What was it like directing a documentary versus, you know, writing a script?
I've definitely learned some things that if I did this again, I would do differently, which I think means I was paying attention and learning. I was always learning something new every time, because I also, one of the first decisions I made early on was, I think I need my own camera. And I figured that out at your school, where I was standing back watching what cameras were doing, but I couldn't tell anyone in time to catch what I was seeing. And I'd pulled out my phone and started filming. And someone was like, you might want to just get your own camera. And that really helped me understand how people were looking through the lens, how to capture the feeling of where we were. And then who was sort of interesting to follow and how to follow them. So I think I always thought a director, and maybe this is just a documentary, I'm learning how to make a documentary, because as a director, I think you plan for everything and you know exactly, you can talk about lenses and LUTs and where you want, and you do this thing with your fingers where you're always like pointing at people with two fingers. I hate it. I don't think I'll ever do it. I think it's so gross looking. I can't take it.
I've never heard of this, so I feel like
people will be like, they're like, you want to come in this way, or you're going to go, we're going to, I hate it so much. Anyway, but, you know, one of the reasons that I enjoyed making comic books was I had to write a script for an artist to illustrate. And so I had to think in storyboards. And that is, you know, A, how we do animation, but B, how as a director, you can see your thing that you're going to make in the shots you want. And so that you can describe, I'd really like to be able to see, here's an example, like setting up the interview in your school. I was like, there's just a black wall behind them. I'd kind of like something a little in between, and not just the furniture or whatever. I saw the costume rack and I said, can we have some of the sequins? Because it was Grease, I think, maybe, that you had off to the side. And so we pulled that costume rack, and then because there was this red sequiny thing next to the red logo on the back, like it had a real, I said, I just want it to feel like we are in a theater room, because you're in a black box. That's such a thing about one act, is we were in so many rehearsal rooms and on stage and in buses and on stage and backstage, that I was like, we have to make sure that we get some sky and we get some fun and we go with them to fast food restaurants and Chili's and all of that stuff. So I think one of the challenges as a director was also, I was also the producer. So I also had to make sure that everybody got where they needed to go. Even if the only producer and film, like camera op on a set, was me, I had to book my flights, book my hotel, get the car, get to the thing, make sure that I, do my cards, you know, get stuff on a drive, make sure it was in two places, because I'm on a plane and I'm one person. Like, there was no sleep. And then I was traveling the state of Texas to do so. There was 1 week that I started in Austin, went to Dallas, went down to Austin, drove to Houston, flew to Corpus, flew back to Houston, flew to LA in 5 days, six contests or something, five contests. I was a wreck. So yeah, also like have a job and a kid and a home, you know, and a mom who needed some medical stuff. So it was difficult. So I think if the project hadn't felt important and rewarding, I probably would have just needed to bail. But I felt like the second someone said yes, and I had one other person involved, I was not going to be able to stop. I just couldn't stop thinking about, you were kind enough to invite me into your world to help tell your story. Then it's my job to get it there.
Did you feel a lot of pressure with having so many different stories from so many different schools, I guess?
I don't have the pressure. I think the pressure was just, can we, well, there was a pressure to not cause anybody to have a problem with the contest because we existed. I felt that pressure a lot, to not make so much attention on a school that other schools felt like they were getting special attention, or we stepped on something. I mean, being backstage in the dark with a set that you don't know because it's not your show, you know, I almost kicked a fog machine easily 3 times, you know, like you're backing up, you've got a camera on your face. There's no one around you to make sure you're walking in there. I don't even understand. There was more than one collision, like a kid just like bammed right into my face or my shoulder or my lens. I'll have to go and look for them and make a super cut, but yeah, it was a little,
you have to,
it was a little bit, there was pressure there of, you only get this one shot. You can't back to one on any of it.
Do you have any, I guess, words of wisdom, aspiration for people that might not really know their voice in film, but they kind of just want to start somewhere and do something? Because, you know, in college, it really seems like, okay, I'm behind other people that are my age that are doing this or doing that. I don't really know my voice, and I don't really know what avenue I want to go to. Like, where would you offer advice around that?
Well, you make smaller versions of the thing you're thinking about making. And I'm not saying it's easy to make a short, but you'll meet some people and you'll learn some stuff and you'll make the process all the way through. I mean, you've made some shorts. Wouldn't you say that by the end of one, you're a better filmmaker than when you started?
Yeah.
Yeah. And not while you were making it, were you like, this was a good idea. It's just once it was over.
Every single one I've been like, I don't know why I did this. I actually must hate myself. I've never wanted something done faster in my life.
Yeah. I got to get this over with. How can I get this over with? And you only think it's a good idea before you've started. And then once it's way finished, and you're like, that was a good idea. But it's because it's hard. It is hard. And so I think that's it. Like, if you're always wondering what it's going to be like and you think you will regret never knowing, then you definitely need to try as soon as possible. If you think you enjoy the dream of it, then stay, like, let that dream be a dream and do something else, because it's too hard to commit yourself to this if it isn't, like, deep down, you know, I'm not trying to say it's a calling, because I think that is more spiritual than this. This is like, I don't know how any other job that I've tried, I'm miserable in, like a different kind of miserable. I feel wasted. Like, I'm just like, my time is being wasted, my aptitude, my all of it. Like, it feels, no, I'm not supposed to be doing this. So, but when I'm doing these other jobs that are really hard, I never question. Maybe I question, like, is this the right gig right now? Or is this the right partner for this? But I never wonder, am I supposed to be doing this at all? And that was never the case in any other job I tried to have. But you also have to know that, like, right now, while you're starting out, you have to have all these jobs, all these weird little jobs to meet all these people and have all these experiences so that you have stories to tell or stories that you come across. And that is your voice is really like your take on something, your point of view, how you see things. And, you know, usually it's the, I want to make a movie like, it's not, I want to make a movie like this movie I saw. It's, I want to make a movie like this movie I've never seen. And that is hard because people are like, well, they haven't made it for a reason. And you're like, no, they haven't made it because I wasn't here yet. That was, that's the only reason.
That's good. That's good. Somebody write that down.
They don't know you're the reason because they can't, they don't know you yet. And also, you can always change your mind. Like, I think when we're really young and make these declarations of who we are and what we want to do, we fear changing our minds publicly because then everyone will think, I'm saying I was wrong. You're not saying you were wrong. You were saying, I have a different track I'd like to try. I'd like to go this way for a minute. I actually went down this path and it didn't suit me. Like all the other ways you want to put wrong, because wrong is too big of a mistake. When you're trying something risky, there's a way to be like, that is not for me, and I'm gonna back up before it's too late for me to get out of it, or I regret the next thing I do, or I don't like the person I am when I'm in this world over here. You can make mistakes. I'm not saying that. I just feel like thinking of an experience where you are trying something risky that feels like a dream shouldn't get labeled a mistake if you decide to change your mind and try something else. It's another version of being too hard on yourself. Yeah, it's like you don't have a mortgage. You don't have a bunch of mouths to feed. You don't have parents to take care of. Like, I know people are like, this is the time. And you're like, with what money? But there's some way to get a version of what you're looking for. And if you're crafty enough, you can figure that out.
Wait, that was good. That was amazing. I feel like we should put that on a t-shirt. You know what I mean?
It's a very long t-shirt. Yeah, it's on the back. It's down the sleeves.
Yes.
I don't think I said anything. I haven't had a succinct answer yet.
Well, see, but you didn't go on a side tangent like me. So you're doing better than I am. Oh my gosh. We've been talking for
an hour.
Yeah.
I'm out of coffee. Really? I don't have short answers to things. And I don't know that I'm being very helpful.
No, but... you are.
Okay. I don't need a pep talk. I just mean, I was fortunate enough to deliver the commencement address a few years ago to the College of Fine Arts at UT. And I'll send you the link to that if you haven't watched it. It is, which is one of the best days of my life, but getting to talk to the Bass Concert Hall filled with people who are proud of someone. There is just everyone there is proud and happy and excited about this day. It's such a rare audience to then walk up and be like, let me give you some advice. But you know, you could feel it. You could feel that collective, joy, but also like pride, which I think is also a little hard to come by lately, right? Of being allowed to be proud of someone, being allowed to be, to just even sit and go, I did that, you know, without feeling like, oh, you know, humble brag and all these things we put on top of, oh, it's cringe. All these ways that we're like trying to tamp down emotion lately, which is so heartbreaking because I felt like these past two generations have come up unapologetically emotional and joyous and emotionally intellectual to get into the nuance of how you feel and why you feel a certain way. And I reject this notion that you should have shame about it, because it's how we develop empathy. The specificity of how you feel and why you see things this way is what builds empathy, is what builds worlds, is what storytelling is all about. And I think that, you know, in the 90s, there was so much satire and snark, right? Early aughts gave way to this word snark. But by the way, wrote for a website that said that was talking about snark. But I think true snark is supposed to be criticism, like literary criticism, right? Where you're really debating this work of art and what does it make you feel and where does this come from and how is this, as opposed to, I don't know, I thought it was boring. Too long, didn't read. You know, that's, I I hope that we are entering a world where we are allowed to spend more time with literally anything, with our thought, with a conversation, with a dinner, to spend more time with each other so that we can really ask, what did you mean by that? Or can I tell you, you know, here we are, we've been talking for an hour. In your mind, it was like, it'll be a quick 20 minutes. But if we did a quick 20 minutes, what was I saying, really? How are we getting into the point of what's so scary about where you're at and what's so scary about where I'm at? And as you have pointed out, not that different. Even though if we look at each other and think, oh, I can guess what her world is like. We cannot. So college feels very like hurry up. But it also is a very compressed period of time where it's suddenly over. It doesn't feel that way right now. But it is pretty quick. If you think about your high school, will feel very long because it is. Because you're like 100 different people while you're in high school. But in college, you're kind of you. You've kind of baked you the you-ness in here. And so now you're like, what am I going to do with this me I've become? But you really have a lot of years to figure that out. But only a few years to do it in this safe, weird little bubble of college that should challenge you, should get you to meet new perspectives and new concepts that you were not allowed or able to see from where you grew up from that perspective. It is, you know, all kinds of new people and things coming together. And that's the best part of college, I think, is you can really have your mind blown on any day. Through a person or a book or a class or a film or theater, whatever it is, like, it's just a whole new, it is designed for you to explore all of your curiosities and boundaries.
I agree with that so much. Oh my gosh. Wait, quick little shout out. I took a class, Intro to Leadership, with Dr. Cockle. And he was just like the most amazing, like, I don't know. I never thought I'd take a class on leadership and fall in love with it. And I was like, this is like, he said something and he was like, you know, we're all really just making stuff up. Like, I'm really just teaching you guys stuff that like someone like made up and like told to me. And like, I'm just making it up as I go. Like, no one really knows what they're talking about. And I was like, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I am paying for this class, but also like, you know what? Yeah. College is great though, but it's weird. It's a lot of, I don't know, a lot of self-exploration in a really, really weird way. Because what do you mean I go back to my dorm and I'm in charge of when I go to sleep? Like, that's no. What do you mean I can go get food at a dining hall literally whenever I want and like no one's going to stop me?
No, you don't even have to go back to your dorm that night. I mean, eventually someone will notice you're gone, but not right away.
No, never, no. Like,
I think it's why it's scary and disheartening what's happening in to the university system, particularly in Texas, of, you know, what is considered teachable, you know, or allowed when these are supposed to be at institutes for different points of view and learning and history and like the stuff that you didn't get to learn earlier. Like, it's supposed to be, you're old enough to handle two different ideas at once, and or seven. You're old enough to not feel pressure to think a certain way. And the concept that it's dangerous to learn, that it's dangerous to learn about past mistakes, is some crazy doublespeak, Orwellian stuff. And I really hope that because you're paying to go there, that you do get to have a right to say what you want to learn and not have all of these avenues removed, quote, for your own good.
Oh no, I was letting you go. I wasn't.
No, that's all. No, I'm just feeling feelings.
I think we should normalize feeling feelings again.
Yeah.
And I think we should all feel more feelings, and I think we should break out into song, specifically singing for good whenever we have feelings.
Yeah.
I say that because that's what I've been doing a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
It's okay. Did you go see Wicked?
No, I have not seen the second one yet. It's here in my house. I haven't watched it yet. I had a lot of deadlines, and you know, it's also very new for me. Like, I didn't know Wicked prior to this.
And that what? First one,
that, yeah, I'm not a musical theater person per se. So I have my five that I really love, but I was not exposed much to it growing up. So I don't know a lot of things that everybody knows. And that first one ended so great. So I was like, that's good. Here's my take. Nobody needs an act two of any musical.
Oh my gosh.
They're all perfect at intermission. You're like, that was so good. That was so good. Even if it is in the middle of a thing, like, so good. That was so good. That was 3.5 hours well spent, that part one.
Oh my gosh.
Maybe Hamilton aside, a lot happens in act two. But I feel like I'm not wrong. I saw Into the Woods.
Oh,
that's done at act one. That's done at act one. Act two is kind of a different musical. I'm not wrong.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not wrong. I don't know the intermission for Annie, but I'm going to tell you all the bangers are in the first half, right? Chicago, all the bangers are in the first half. Second half, you get, I don't even know. Always. You're like, you're really, and nowadays, you're having to like remember the second half.
I have never in my entire 19 years of living heard someone say, nah, this should just stop at intermission. We should all just dip, y'all.
There could be, we can all come back for act two some other time. But this is a contained, it's great. Everybody's like, woo! And it's been a long time. Like, your act one break in a musical is often like 90 minutes in, right? I'm not wrong. I've only seen 10 musicals, so I might be wrong.
I'm going to start crying. Oh my God. I'm like, okay, my favorite musical is The Notebook, the Broadway musical, obviously, okay. Yeah. But like, if you're literally picturing The Notebook, like the movie, not the musical, like I'm trying to imagine, like the intermission, at least in the musical, is right when like Allie comes back to the house, like as her older, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine, like the musical
That's
can't
fine.
End there.
I understand that. I would like to say that that is a musical based on a film that is the right length. So I bet it's longer. I bet it's longer than The Notebook. I bet it's longer because of the songs. But all I'm saying is these things are very long. These are very long. I mean, they should be. They cost a lot of money to go and all these people are working so hard. I'm not saying it's a broken art form. I'm saying for me.
One act is perfect for you.
That's why I'm making a documentary about it. 40 minutes. Let's get it in here. It's very exciting. I like my books long and my plays short.
Oh my
and
gosh.
My bass down low.
Oh yeah. My gosh. Please. Oh my gosh. Wow.
I think we've done a lot of good here today, Reese.
I think we need to end there because I feel partially hurt.
I understand.
That, like, wow.
Yeah, that's what college is all about.
Because I knew you.
Yeah.
Like, wow, you don't even know the song. Do you know the
I
song?
Don't. I don't, but it sure sounds like it was in many other musicals. Those four words you just said. That's the end of every musical.
No!
I knew you. Is that from Wicked? Or is it from The Notebook? Couldn't it also be from The Notebook? Tell me I'm wrong. Because I knew you. That's every musical at the end.
Whoa. In The Notebook, they say, you'll always be my home. They don't say, because I knew you.
Mm. What did you just sing, though? Oh, I see. But because I knew you, you'll always be my home. I'm just saying, parentheses. Every song. Parentheses. Because I knew you. Mm-hmm. Every last song in a musical.
I don't know how to wrap up because I feel like my heart.
Let's just
is
end
just
it up. Here at Act One. It's the end of Act One. It's been an hour and some change. Everybody go get some popcorn.
Wow.
We feel like we aren't quite finished it yet. We'd maybe like it to go on, but also had a lot of feelings. had some memorable moments. Let's see what happens. Will maybe there'll be an act two.
Just like in the Notebook.
Yeah, in movies we call it a sequel.
This has been great. I'm going to pretend the last
It's a weird way. It's a weird way to get yourself canceled. I'm sure it's a controversial statement. That's why I really haven't said it to many people.
Yeah, no one in the history of the human race has ever had that should be your hot take.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I like being different, but
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, whenever we go to Sundance and, you know, Tribeca or whatever, they're going to be like, what's your hot take after doing a documentary? And you're going to be like, yeah, musicals should not have a second act. And they're going to be like, what does that have to do?
It's not what I said. I said every musical could end at the end of act one and we would still love it just as much. What is act two doing that we didn't already have feelings for in act one? We're in. Love it all. Love the story. Love the characters. Love the songs. Love the dance. Love the spectacle. What is act two doing? It's more.
My heart just like.
I'm sure I'm wrong. I'm sure I'm wrong.
I'm hurting. That like hurt me.
That's okay.
Wow. But this has been great. I didn't even. This is my list of questions right here. They're front and back.
Oh my gosh, that was so much work we didn't get to. I apologize.
No, I it was literally like a backup in case I just, you know, blanked out and couldn't think of anything, but like it's us and, you know,
yeah. We could go all day.
We really could go all day. Like a
join us next time on Reese and Pam Get Into It.
Yeah, the unwriting of our story.
Unwriting together, because the longer we're talking, the less we're writing. Welcome to unwriting.
Whoa. I haven't written anything in ages. Okay, that's a side tangent for another day, though. All right. Okay, this has been great. Thank you for agreeing to do this. And yeah, I really appreciate it. I hope you have a great day. And I hope you watch a sequel or the second act of a musical. And
I'll probably turn this Wicked on. I'll probably turn it on.
I think we could all use a good cry, so therefore you should watch it.
Okay.
And after you watch it, you have to text me and be like, wow, I totally want to change my view frame. That was amazing. I forget everything I said. Yeah.
And I will tell you to watch The Testament of Anne Lee and tell me what happens after you've seen this. Ooh. Yeah. It's called The Testament of Anne Lee. It's about the creation of the Shakers, this religion. She is the creator of it. It's starring Amanda Seyfried.
I love her.
I can't wait to find out what you think when you watch it. It's as long as a musical, so I know you have the stamina.
Whoa, I barely made it through Marty Supreme, and I only saw it for the second time because George wanted to see it like really bad, and I was like, George, I need you to understand it's gonna be uncomfortable for both of us at some point. And he didn't believe me. But good movie though. But I'm gonna watch it.
Okay, all right, thanks Reese, have a great semester.
Thanks. I would say you too, but
we're all living semesters. It's fine. We're just trying everything out a few months at a time, seeing if there's more when that's over.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Enjoy your semester.
Thank you. I hope I get A's.
Oh, yeah. Straight A's and make the dean's list. Absolutely.
Definitely. Can't wait. Yeah. All right. I'll see you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Send me your thoughts. Let me know if you learned something, if you agree with Pam's hot take. You can find me on Instagram @ReeseWRI. I'll see you next time. And until then, keep creating and keep talking.